Om sahanavavatu sahanau bhunaktu sahavidyan karavavahai tejasvi navadhitamastu mavidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti Om namo bhagavate Om vaivasvataya mrityave vaivasvataya Brahmavidyacharyaya Brahmavidyacha Nachiketase cha Nachiketase cha. Very good. So we have come to the last section of our Katha Upanishad. It's composed of six valis. Vali is a name for these sections. There were three valis in the first half, and we have reached the third vali of the second and final half. So we have just several more classes, and we'll conclude this study. Before we proceed, I just want to make a brief comment on some of our discussion from last week, last class. In the last class, we had a rather elaborate and technical discussion about vritti vyapti and pala vyapti, and I gave examples of the gatakara vritti and akandakara vritti. This was a fairly technical subject matter, and I want to put it in context for you. Where does such kinds of technical discussion fit into our sadhana, into our spiritual practice? And it's all part of a broader process, the process of Vedanta, which is primarily pramana vichara. You may not have heard this expression, but it's an important one. Pramana vichara. Thank you. Vichara means inquiry. Pramana is a means of knowledge. Vedanta is a pramana. Vedanta is a means of knowledge for knowing the self, for knowing reality, for knowing truth. So to inquire by means of a pramana is a primary feature of Vedanta. In fact, to inquire by means of a pramana is what we call shravana. What we're doing now is to inquire into the truth of ourselves, making use of a pramana. This is what we call pramana vichara. Those of you who know some Sanskrit know that compounds like pramana vichara can lend themselves to several different interpretations, and there's a second one. The first meaning of this is inquiry by means of a pramana, which is the teachings of Vedanta, the wisdom of the ancient rishis. But the second way of understanding this compound, which is equally important, is a vichara, an inquiry into the pramana. That's a whole different inquiry. First, it's a vichara, it's an inquiry into your true nature by means of a pramana, and that's what we call shravana. But now the second interpretation of this, second meaning for the same compound word, the second meaning is an inquiry into the pramana itself. To inquire into the nature of the pramana, how it works, is part of what we call manana. We'll leave nididhyasana out for the time being. But manana is this process of reflection on the teachings for the sake of removing doubts, vagueness, lack of clarity. A good way of understanding this distinction, the two meanings of pramana vichara, suppose you use a microscope to learn about these little microbes on a slide. To use the microscope is equivalent of using a pramana. to look through the microscope and examine those little microbes on the slide is the equivalent of inquiry into the nature of the self by means of a pramana. Instead of a microscope, we're using the teachings of Vedanta. So to look through the microscope at the microbes is the equivalent, metaphorically, of shravana. But suppose you spend some time studying the microscope. Now, why would you do that? Well, if you were more competent in using the microscope, you might be more effective in looking through it. If you knew how it worked, if you knew how to maintain it, if you knew how to use it in a greater level of detail, it would enhance your ability to look through it. That's describing now the second process. So to inquire, to study the microscope, metaphorically, represents an inquiry not into Atma, but an inquiry into the nature of the pramana, the nature of the teachings of Vedanta. So let's make it very clear, though. By studying the microscope, what will you learn about microbes? Nothing. And in the same way, a philosophical discussion about the teachings of Vedanta in and of itself will not yield self-knowledge. It will not yield moksha, which is the whole purpose of Vedanta. On the other hand, just as knowledge of the microscope could be very useful for one who uses the microscope, in the same way, this kind of scholarly inquiry, manana, this fairly scholarly inquiry into how the teachings of Vedanta work can be quite useful. So that was the nature of our discussion in the prior class, all part of manana. Now, we're ready to move on to the final vali of the Kathopanishad. Every one of these valis have a different flavor, a different character. It really, it has the flavor of the ancient rishis. And that sounds very strange, but when I say flavor, a certain poetic approach, a certain non-systematic approach, not systematic at all. The material just jumps all over the place because it's a compilation of these inspirations. When you get inspired, is that something very methodical and thought out? In fact, the very fact that we call it inspired suggests that it's not premeditated, it's not organized. And so what we're seeing here is like that. These inspired teachings, which are not systematic, which are not well organized, but which are full of vision. And after all, that's what we're really after, is that vision of the ancient rishis. So let us proceed. Urdhva mulo vakshaka urdhva mulo eshoshvatta sanatanaha eshoshvatta tadeva shukram tad brahma tadeva tadevamrutamuchyate tadevam tasmin loka shrita sarve tasmin loka tarunatyeti kashchana tarunatyeti etadvaitata. Some of this looks familiar, we've seen in prior valis, but it begins actually with something that may be familiar for a different reason. If you studied the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, it begins with this stunning metaphor, urdhva mulam adashakam ashvatam. There is an ashvata tree. This is a presentation in chapter 15. A tree, but not an ordinary kind of tree. This is a tree with the mulam, with the roots, urdhva. The roots are above, and adha shakam, and the shaka, the branches, are adha, below. So this metaphor opens chapter 15 of the Bhagavad Gita. Where do you think Sri Krishna got that metaphor from? I wonder. So it comes directly, and we've observed already before that more than a few verses and teachings of the Bhagavad Gita seem to be directly derived from the Katha Upanishad, and this is no exception. Language is a little different. Urdhva mulaha avakshakaha eshaha ashvattaha. Eshaha ashvattaha. There is this tree, this ashvatta tree, a fig tree, or Shankaracharya says it's a tula tree, a silk cotton tree. I don't even know what is a silk cotton tree. I don't even really know what is a fig tree. Anyway, this is an ashvatta tree, which is urdhva mulaha. The roots are mula, roots are urdhvam, above, and the shakaha, the branches, are avak, meaning below. Now, obviously, it's a metaphor. When we talk about the vision of the rishis, don't think that they saw in their mind's eye some tree with the roots above and branches below. This is a metaphor. And it's an image in the form of words and ideas. And its meaning is very significant. The meaning in the 15th chapter and the meaning that we get here. The root of a tree represents its source. The branches represent that which is manifest. Notice that when you look at a tree, do you see the roots? You don't see the roots. But without those roots, that tree could most certainly not exist. The existence of that tree depends on roots which are unseen, roots that are unknown. In this metaphor, the branches, and Shankara goes, talk about going off on a tangent. I don't go off on tangents like Sri Shankara in this. Yeah, he just goes on and on and on with his metaphor. I don't think we'll follow all of that. But just to give it in summary, the branches of the tree represent the world, the manifest world. And Shankara goes on, the fruits of the tree are the karma pala, and the branches mean this, and the leaves mean this. And even there's a bird in a tree in a nest. So Shankara gives all of his details. We'll set that aside. But it's significant that just as the tree can't exist without roots which are not visible, in the same way this manifest universe could not exist without an underlying reality because of which it exists. And that underlying reality because of which it exists, tadeva shukram tad brahma, that underlying reality is what we call Brahman. Brahman is that underlying reality because of which the manifest world exists. When you look at the tree, you don't see the roots. When we look at the world around us, we don't see Brahman. When you look at the tree, you can infer the presence of roots. When we look at the world around us, we can infer Brahman, but that's philosophy. To rely on mere inference is what philosophers do. This is not philosophy. If we look at the world and we recognize that this world is a manifest something, something cannot exist without an underlying reality, something can't exist because of nothing. Something must exist because of something. So that something is the underlying reality because of which the universe exists. That's something we call Brahman. And now we have what we call an inference. And it's nothing wrong with the inference. It's a fine inference. Just as understanding that there are roots when you see a tree. The inference is absolutely fine. There's no defect in the inference. But inference is weak. Why is it weak? It's based on reasoning and logic. Is reasoning and logic perfect? It's an activity of our mind. Being an activity of our mind, being a tool that we use in the mind, there's no way to guarantee that inference is perfect. It might be reasonable. It might be correct. When you see the tree, to infer the presence of roots is a correct inference. In the same way, when we see the world around us, to infer the existence of Brahman is a correct inference. But inference alone is not enough. If inference alone is all we have, then Vedanta gets reduced to philosophy. But how then can we understand this not as an inference? So let's pick up the thread here. This urdhva mulaha avakshakaha esha ashvataha. This ashvata tree, having its branches below and its roots above, is sanatanaha. It's eternal. It's eternal, meaning the roots were never created. The branches may come and go. In fact, if you chop down, you may have this problem, if like a weed or something. If you cut off the weed or a small tree and you think, we're done. No, it comes back. It sprouts again. So it's not that the branches are eternal, the root is eternal. Tad Brahma, that Brahman, which is the root of this metaphorical tree. Samsara Vriksha is a term we often use. Samsara Vriksha, the tree of worldly life. So this Ashvata tree represents the Samsara Vriksha, the tree of worldly life. And if you just chop down the branches, it comes up again. So here, that's what's meant here by sanatana. The root is unborn, uncreated. Tadeva tad brahma, that Brahman, which is the root of this tree. Tadeva shukram, and here's the key. Shukra means bright, shining. Here's Shankara. Tadasya samsara vrikshasya mulam, for that tree of samsara, the mulam, the root, tadeva shukram, that root is shukra. What do you mean? Shubra, shining, shuddha, pure, jyotishmat, shining, like light, chaitanyatma jyotisabhavam. That light is chaitanyatma. It is the conscious self. Look at this. If we only infer the presence of roots, then that's inference is indirect. There's nothing, when you infer the presence of roots, is that direct knowledge or indirect knowledge? It's indirect knowledge. You know it by means of something else. You don't know it directly. But when we speak of Brahma Vidya, knowledge of Brahman, knowledge of reality, we're not talking about, the ancient rishis are not describing some kind of indirect knowledge. Brahma Vidya for the ancient rishis is direct knowledge. How can you have direct knowledge of that, of the mulam, of the roots of that samsara vriksha? Now we could be silly and say you go outside with a shovel and dig up the roots, but this is like messing with the metaphor. It's destroyed. The metaphor is not meant to work like that. Besides, anyway, this samsara vriksha has the roots above. Where will you dig? So let's put that aside. There's another way of understanding the roots directly, the root for the samsara vriksha. The reality because of which, this is the language we used before, but it comes right back again. That Brahman, which is the root for the samsara vriksha, the reality because of which everything exists, it's the reality because of which you exist. And the essence of your existence is as consciousness. The essence of the tree's existence is the root. The essence of the world's existence is Brahman. The essence of your existence is consciousness. The consciousness because of which you exist, and the underlying reality because of which the cosmos exists, are not two separate realities. It's one and the same reality. So how can that Brahman be known directly? You can infer indirectly, know that Brahman, by observing the world and reasoning backwards, inferring the presence of an underlying reality. But here in Vedanta, we go beyond that inference and recognize that in our own minds, the consciousness that is present, immediately present in this very experience, that consciousness is non-different from that reality because of which the samsara vriksha, the tree of worldly life, exists. Brahman is known directly as the consciousness manifest in your own mind. I'll say that again because this is a very direct way of understanding the Mahavakya. The consciousness present in your mind right now, the consciousness manifest, the consciousness present in this very experience, that consciousness is non-different from the Brahman, from the reality because of which everything exists. One of the four Mahavakyas quoted frequently, prajnanam brahma. There it is, in two words. Prajnanam means consciousness. Prajnanam brahma. That Brahman, the reality because of which everything exists, is not other than consciousness. Not your consciousness. There's no your consciousness or my consciousness. There's only consciousness. So this is what Shankaracharya points out, where he says that Shukram, well, here the Rishi says, Tadeva Shukram, that Brahman is Shukram. It is bright. It is shining. And in Sri Shankaracharya's language, Chaitanyatma Jyoti Sabhavam, that Brahman is shining as the consciousness manifest in your own mind. All right. Tad Brahma Tadeva Amritam Uchyate Tadeva, and that Brahman in Uchyate is described as Amritam, immortality, unborn, uncreated. That which is Amritam, unborn, uncreated, is not merely the root of the tree of samsara, but the root of your own existence. The consciousness because of which you exist is also Amrita. It's the same Amrita, the same unchanging, uncreated reality. Okay, further. Tasmin, upon that Brahman, Lokaha Shataha Sarve, Sarve Lokaha, all the worlds are Shrataha, all of the worlds are established on that Brahman. Just like the tree represents a cosmos. You can imagine each branch representing different things. How about, I won't, instead of Shankara's example, Shankara's explanation, I'll give a different one. How about on that tree of samsara, each, here we'll give a very modern interpretation. How about that? Each leaf is a galaxy. How's that? Each leaf of that tree is a galaxy. Each cell in each leaf is a solar system. And within each cell are countless proteins and molecules and atoms. I suppose at some point, maybe we can say the electrons represent you and me. How's that? So a modern interpretation of this metaphor. So just as all the leaves are hanging on that tree and a manifestation that exists because of the root, in the same way, sarve lokaha, all the worlds, all the galaxies, all the dimensions, all of them are shritaha. They exist depending upon tasmin, upon that Brahman. They exist on that Brahman. They depend on that Brahman for their existence. That Brahman being the root for the tree of samsara. Taru na atyeti kashchana. We've seen this exact statement three times now. Once in the prior vali, once in the vali before that, and now in this vali. Tat, that, ooh, indeed. Na atyeti kashchana. Na kashchana, nothing. Atyeti transcends. Tat, that one. Nothing transcends that one. What one? The roots. The tree can grow higher and higher, but the tree Actually, this is the upside down tree, so we have to go that way. The roots are above, remember? Urdhva Moolam. All right. So with the roots above and the branches are growing below, the branches can spread out and spread out and spread out like the banyan tree. It just goes on spreading out and spreading out and spreading out. So those branches can continue to spread out down and sideways. Remember, this is an upside down tree. So the branches extend down and laterally, but not up. The branches cannot exceed the height of the root. This is a metaphor. The branches can never exceed the height of the root. The root is a source for that tree. And in the same way, this worldly manifestation of Brahman cannot exceed or transcend Brahman. So just going with that visual, that imagery, just as these branches going down and laterally can never transcend the root of that samsara vriksha, in the same way this manifest universe can never, nothing in this nakashchana, nothing in this manifest universe, atyeti, can transcend tad brahma, that Brahman. Etad vaitata unachiketas, this etat is tat, that. This is that which you asked about, O Nachiketas. So there's the first of the verses in our last vali. And continuing to talk about that Brahman, that's our opening subject matter. The nature, what is the nature of that Brahman, which is the root of the samsara vriksha? Yadidan kincha jagat sarvam, yadidan chacha. Prana hejati nisritam, prana hejati mahadbhayam vajramudyatam yaha, mahadbhayam vajramudyatam yaha, etad viduramritaste bhavanti, etad viduramritaste varanti. Good. Yadidam kincha jagat sarvam. Jagat sarvam. Sarvam, all. Jagat, all this world, this entire universe, the manifest universe represented by the tree's branches. This entire universe, yadidam kincha, whatever is present here in this manifest universe, all that exists in this manifest universe, all of this is nisritam. It is nisritam. It is manifest. Literally, it's that which has been created out of something else. It has been manifest from something else. It has been born. It has been created, nisritam, simply. It has been created. So it is created how? This word prane, the A dropped because of some grammar rules, prane is a little problematic. This entire world is in prana. Now we conventionally understand prana as life force, but here it doesn't directly mean life force. Shankara gives a rather obscure explanation. Prane parasmin brahmani sati. I don't know how he gets there, but according to Sri Shankara, prane, this entire world exists in prana, is what's literally said here in the verse. In prana means, according to Sri Shankara, parasmin brahmani, in Brahman, in the absolute Brahman. So prana doesn't ordinarily mean that, but when a word is used, when a word is really odd, if you're reading a book, and you see a word that really sticks out as being odd, you have to figure out, what is that word doing there? There must be some reason, some meaning for it. And that's what Shankara has done. Let me offer you a little different interpretation that might be a little bit more accessible. And that is, prana is definitely a manifestation of Brahman. So prane sati, since Brahman is manifest as life, since Brahman is manifest as life, and since we have this entire universe Yadidam kincha jagat sarvam. This entire universe with all the stuff within it, this entire universe with all of its bits and pieces, all of this exists prane, along with the life force, which is a manifestation of Brahman. And therefore, all of this which is nisrutam, all of this which is created, ajati, it moves, it acts, it springs to life, it functions. Prane sati, since Brahman is manifest as life, therefore, this entire universe moves. We could say kind of poetically, the world dances. Because of Brahman's manifestation as life itself, as prana, therefore the world dances. Not just dances, dances to his tune. And that's exactly what the second line says. The world dances not randomly. Imagine if the entire world acted randomly. If electrons sometimes went around the nucleus and sometimes didn't. If your heart sometimes beat correctly and sometimes didn't. Imagine if the universe were disorderly and didn't follow laws, didn't follow principles that we understand as scientific principles, laws of nature. So therefore, the entire world, ajati, it moves, it functions, it dances, so to speak, according to Ishvara's laws. Ishvara's laws being a manifestation of Brahman, just as prana, that life force, is a manifestation of Brahman. The laws of the universe are a manifestation of Brahman. Now look how this is expressed poetically. So when we say that the world functions according to the life force of Brahman, the world dances according to Brahman's manifestation of life force, of energy, of the laws of the cosmos. Therefore, that Brahman is Mahadbhayam. That Brahman is a source of great fear. Great fear? Mahadbhayam. Great fear. What kind of fear? Vajramudyatam. Just like a vajram, a thunderbolt, a lightning. Lightning which is udyatam, held up. Just like you can imagine some god holding a thunderbolt in his hand, holding it aloft. That symbol of power, that udyatam vajram, that thunderbolt held aloft, is a source of mahadbhayam, great fear. And in this way, Brahman is represented as a source of great fear. This metaphor may not work too well for us having modern minds. Let's work at this a little bit. We're really talking about the laws of the cosmos. Brahman's manifestation as the laws of the cosmos, such as the law of gravity, all the electromagnetic force, and all of these complicated principles that we understand through science. There are different kinds of laws, some of which are, like, just to give a very mundane example, speed limit. Every road has a speed limit. The road out in front here, this Cortel U Lane, has a speed limit, right? What is the speed limit? 30, I think. Is it 35? 30? Okay, 30. I should warn you that if you ever come down this road during the commuting times, very frequently there will be a Franklin Township police car in our parking lot, waiting to catch speeders. This goes on. Sometimes it's every day they're there. And when this guy is there, he gives someone a ticket. He comes back and parks in our parking lot. And within a minute, he's out after the next guy. Because no one drives 30 miles an hour on this road. Everyone goes speeding along. It's a word of warning for you. Now, when you see that police car and you're driving a little bit too fast, what do you feel? Fear. You see the police car, you feel fear. Why? That police car represents the law that you have to abide with. You abide to the speed limit laws out of fear. This is a metaphor. We're going to see this much more in the next verse. So out of fear, you follow the speed limit laws. Out of fear, in a metaphorical sense, out of fear, the planets circle the sun. Out of fear, electrons go around a nucleus. Do you get the metaphor? Again, it's a little bit archaic for us, but you got this. You got the speed limit idea. So if out of fear you obey a speed limit, you obey the law, then could we not metaphorically say that out of fear, remember in ancient times, the planets were looked upon as deities. So out of fear, the planets circled the sun. Out of fear, the plants grow. Out of fear, the winds blow. Out of fear, the rain falls. This is a metaphor that was used in ancient times. We'll see it again in the next verse. Well, let's just finish up this verse. So that Brahman, manifest as the laws of the cosmos, is Mahadbhayam. It is the lawgiver, the one who is a manifestation of great fear, like a Vajram Udyatam, just like Udyata, lifted up, raised Vajram, thunderbolt. Yaha etad viduhu, ye etad viduhu, ye, those who, etat, this Brahman as the source of the laws of the cosmos, ye etad viduhu, those who understand Brahman to be the source of the laws of the cosmos, te amritaha bhavanti, amritaha, immortal, bhavanti. They become immortal. They become immortal. They become enlightened, is the sense. So knowing Brahman as the underlying reality because of which the laws of the cosmos exist. And the laws of the cosmos is what's metaphorically represented as fear of Brahman. And we'll see that in the next verse. So those Yeviduhu, those who understand Brahman to be the source of the laws of the universe, te amritaha bhavanti, they become immortal. Now, that fear is elaborated upon, elaborated upon in the third mantra here. Bhayadas yagnis tapati, bhayadas yagnis, bhayatapati suryaha, bhayatapati, bhayarindrascha vayuscha, bhayarindrascha, mrityurdhavati panchamaha, mrityurdhavati. Good. Asya bhayat, I'm just changing the order of the first two words. Bhayat, due to fear, asya, of that. Due to fear of that Brahman. Remember, this fear is metaphorical. Due to fear, you could say due to the power of that Brahman. Fear is a power that made you slow down on the road. That's the sense. Fear is a power that made you slow down. So here we're talking about this metaphoric fear, which is the power of Brahman as the laws of the cosmos. So bhayat asya, due to that fear of Brahman, due to that power of Brahman manifest as the laws of the cosmos, due to that fear, agnihi tapati, due to fear of Brahman, fire burns. That's literal. Due to fear of Brahman, fire burns. What does it mean? Due to the power of the laws of the cosmos, which is a manifestation of Brahman, fire burns. Now you get the metaphor a little better? In the same way, bhayat tapati suryaha. Bhayat, due to fear of Brahman, Suryaha, the sun, tapati, shines. Due to fear of Brahman, the sun shines. If you take that very literally, it sounds kind of silly, but if you understand the metaphor, so that fear represents the power of the laws of nature, which is a manifestation of Brahman. So due to the laws of nature, the sun shines. Bhayat indraha cha vayuhu cha. And due to fear, bhayat, indraha, Indra, the king of the gods, does whatever he does, rules in heaven. And also vayuhu, the wind blows. So due to fear of Brahman, literally, due to fear of Brahman, Indra rules and the winds blow. What does it mean? Due to Brahman's manifestation as the laws of the cosmos, due to that, Indra rules the heavens and Vayu, the airs blow. Finally, Mrityuhu Dhavati, Panchamaha. Mrityuhu, death, which is Panchamaha, the fifth that we're talking about. After talking about Agni and Surya and Indra and Vayuhu, we're talking about the fifth, which is Mrityuhu. So Mrityu, which is the Panchamaha, the fifth that we're talking about, Mrityuhu, what an expression, Dhavati, runs. Where is he running? After you. It's the truth. Mrityu is running after all of us. And we're running as fast as we can. So far, we're doing okay. Eventually, the question is, who runs faster? Right now, we're running faster. Eventually, we're slowing down, right? So eventually, we'll slow down sufficient. So Mrityuhu Dhavati. Death will run and death will catch up to us. All right. This is beautiful poetry. A few of you may have studied the Taittiriya Upanishad, and we find almost the same teaching in the Taittiriya Upanishad. It was just in my ear so much. There's a passage that comes in the Anandavali of the Taittiriya Upanishad. Bhishma smad vatav pavate bhishodeti suryaha bhishasmaragnishchendrascha mrityurdhavati panchamayati. Same teaching. Bhisha asmat. Bhisha, because of fear, asmat, of him. Because of fear of Brahman, vataha, the winds, pavate, blow. Because of fear of Brahman, the winds blow. Bhisha udeti suryaha. Because of fear, suryaha, the sun, udeti, rises. Bhisha asmat, because of fear, asmat, of him. Agnihi cha indraha cha. Same. Fire burns, Indra rules, and finally, Mrityuhu Dhavati Panchamaha Iti. Same. Mrityu runs after us, and Mrityu being the Panchamaha, being the fifth. So almost a very parallel passage that comes in the Taittiriya Upanishad. All right. So, just before we move on, we can go back to that same inference that we talked about in the first verse. When you see the branches, you infer the roots. And we said that we go beyond the inference, but let's recognize it is still a valid inference. Inference is not enough, yet it is a valid inference. So to say that we see the manifest world around us, we can infer the existence of a Brahman, which is the underlying reality because of which all this exists. Even though that inference is not adequate for Brahma Vidya, it still is a valid inference. We can make some more inferences. Because fire burns, we can infer Brahman. How? Well, fire burns according to laws of the cosmos. laws of the cosmos are not self-existent. They exist because of the underlying reality, which is Brahman. So we can use the same kind of inference. When you see the tree, you can infer the presence of the roots. When you see fire burn, you can infer the existence of an underlying reality because of which the laws of nature exist. When you see the wind blow, in fact, this is a double inference. You don't see the wind blow, right? You see the trees move. So seeing the trees move, you infer that the wind is blowing. That's first inference one. Now we have another inference. Seeing the wind blow, knowing the wind blows, you can infer Brahman as the underlying reality because of which the laws of nature exist, which cause the wind to blow. So it's a double inference. So seeing because of the wind, you can infer the presence of Brahman. Seeing the sun shine, or the sun rise as it comes in the Taittiriya, the sun rises. In the Kathopanishad, it's the sun shining. Seeing the sun shine, or seeing the sun rise, once again, we can infer the existence of Brahman, the underlying reality, because of which the laws of the universe exist. And final inference is seeing Mrityu running after us. How do you see Mrityu running after you? That's too easy. Look in the mirror. It's called aging. So the effect of aging on our bodies is Mrityu running after us. So once again, from all of this, we can infer the existence of Brahman as the underlying reality because of which the laws of the cosmos exist. Those laws of the cosmos are metaphorically the source of fear that makes the universe dance, according to the laws of the cosmos. Okay, enough. Now we can move on. The prior verse said, those etad viduhu, those who understand Brahman as the source of the intelligent order of the universe, amrataha bhavanti, they become immortal. And that's elaborated upon. That was in the second verse. That point comes back here in the fourth verse. Should really call them mantras, not verses. Iha cheda shakad bodhum, iha cheda shakad Praksharirasya visrasaha, praksharirasya tatasargeshu lokeshu, tatasarge shariratvaya kalpate, shariratvaya. Iha chet, suppose. Iha, here, in this world, in this life, suppose. Ashakat bodhum. Suppose someone ashakat, what is the past tense, was able bodhum to understand. Suppose iha, here in this life, ashakat bodhum, someone was able to understand prak before the visrasaha, the disintegration, sharirasya, of the body. Before death. Prak sharirasya visrasaha, prior to one's death. Chet, suppose, iha, here in this life, ashakat bodhum, someone was able to understand the truth of Brahman. Now, is chet, suppose, then the other part is missing. If I just say, suppose someone understand, suppose someone gains Brahma Vidya. I'm just to paraphrase this verse. Suppose someone gains Brahma Vidya before they die. I'm paraphrasing that line. What would you say? Then what? Well, then what is missing from the verse? So Shankaracharya supplies it. Suppose someone, before they die, is able to gain Brahma Vidya. Then what? Samsara bandhanat vimuchyate. Then Shankara fills in the blanks. It's like, when you ever remember when you're children, all these fill in a blank homework assignments and tests. So this is like a fill-in-the-blank mantra. Suppose, prior to your death, you're able to gain brahmavidya, knowledge of Brahman. Then what? Samsara bandhanat vimuchyate. Then one becomes free from the bondage of samsara. We've discussed all this before. It's a very general language. One becomes free from the bondage of samsara. Notice I said iha, here, while you're alive. So the bondage of samsara is not only when you're dead. This is a I'm not sure if we've discussed it here, certainly in our Bhagavad Gita class and elsewhere. We've discussed the common misconception that moksha is just about freeing you from future bondage and future lives. Well, that may be true, but here in Shankara's language, samsara bandhanat vimuchyate, and in the verse, iha, here in this life, you become freed from the bondage of samsara. So the bondage of samsara could affect you in the next life, but put it this way, whether or not the bondage of samsara will affect you in your next life, we have no way of knowing for sure. It's a matter of belief. It's an unverifiable belief. We can neither prove nor disprove any future life. So that future life, if there is a future life, there will be bondage of samsara. But how do we know there's a future life? We presume there is, we believe there is, we have no way of knowing there is. One thing we know for sure is that we suffer a life of bondage now. No one can dispute the fact that we live a life of suffering. Suffering is a part of every person's life. There's no way to live without suffering. Samsara bandhana is the bondage of samsara, means being stuck in a condition of suffering. And here, the first line says, iha, here, in this very life. Ashakat bodhum. Suppose someone can gain brahma vidya in this very life, and Shankara concludes the statement, therefore samsara bandhanat vimuchyate, in this very life they become free from bondage to a life of suffering. This is jivan mukti, the terms we've used before. Jivan mukti means to be liberated from suffering while you're alive, and then when you die, you gain videha mukti, freedom in the absence of a body. Jivan mukti, freedom while you're alive. Videha mukti, freedom in the absence of a body after one's death. All right, that's the first line. So the first line, this verse seems to be missing lots of bits. So first it says, chait, suppose. Suppose you're able to get enlightenment in this life, then what? So Shankara fills that in. Now the next line is also missing something. What the next line is missing is this. Suppose you're not able to gain enlightenment in this life before you die. That's missing from the verse. But the verse is kind of simple. And if you really understand the mantra, the verse, like you call it verse, it's a mantra. If you really understand what the rishi is saying, then it's pretty easy. When you were a kid filling in those blanks, they were pretty easy to fill in, weren't they? They were very easy to fill in. So in the same way, this verse looks pretty incomplete, but it's really easy to fill in the blanks. So filling in the blank for the second half. First half says, suppose someone was able to gain enlightenment in this life. Now the second half begins by filling in the blank. Suppose someone was not able to gain knowledge of Brahman before the end of this life, before one's body followed. Tataha, therefore, as a result of not gaining Brahma Vidya before death, therefore, sargeshu lokeshu shariratvaya kalpate. Therefore, tataha, as a result, shariratvaya kalpate. Kalpate, the person becomes fit fit for sharirathvaya, fit for gaining another body. That person becomes endowed with another body, sargeshu lokeshu, in another created world, in another universe, in another time and place. That person will gain another body in another time and place, sargeshu lokeshu. That person, kalpate, becomes fit for gaining another body, which means that person is endowed with another body, another life, and another place, and another time. Tataha, as a result of not gaining brahma vidya. And the reason for that, of course, is the doctrine of karma. Reincarnation is driven by karma, but suppose there's no one who owns the karma. To really go through it in great detail, we'd have to unfold the whole doctrine of karma, which is not the time and place to do that right now. Those of you who have heard me explain the doctrine of karma, you can make this connection very nicely. That sanchita karma, infinite collection of punya and papa, that sanchita karma is out there waiting for every single person, so that when you die, that sanchita karma is waiting then to drive the sukshma sharira to take on another physical body for the sake of discharging all of those unfulfilled karmas. But suppose brahma vidya destroys the owner of the karma. Brahma vidya does not destroy karma. Nothing destroys karma. Only exhausting karma removes it. When karma gets fructified, then it's gone. Brahma vidya does not destroy karma. Brahma vidya destroys ownership of the karma. Brahma vidya destroys you, the limited individual. The only one that survives brahma vidya is Satchidananda Atma. The limited individual gets destroyed. The survivor, Satchidananda Atma. Satchidananda Atma doesn't get reincarnated. Therefore, that's Videha Mukti. Okay. And in the absence of Videha Mukti, as long as that ignorance persists, as long as the doer of karma, as long as a karma karta, the agent of karma, as long as you exist as a limited individual, you own the karma. You own a lot of karma. You own not just this prarabdha karma, which will keep you going for another number of years, but you own an infinite amount of punya and papa karma, which we call sanchitta, the result of an infinite number of prior lives that should keep you going for a long time. How long? Infinite time. Until and unless one gains brahma vidya. Okay. So this verse talks then about the pala, the fruits of brahma vidya. I think we'll see one more verse. And this next verse is quite interesting. I like it. Next mantra, number 5.
Yatha darsheta tatmani, yatha darsheta. Yatha swapne tatha pitra loke, yatha swapne tatha pitra. Yathapsu pariva dadrishe, yathapsu pariva dadrishe, tatha gandharva loke, tatha gandhar. Chayatapayoriva brahma loke, chayatapayoriva brahma loke.
This verse ends, this mantra ends with the, actually, Shankara, anyway, we'll, in a few minutes we'll come to, I think, some of the most powerful teachings of Sri Shankara, commenting on the end of this verse. But this mantra begins, Yatha adarshe tatha atmani. Very terse. Four words giving an immense teaching. The literal meaning of these four words, Yatha adarshe, just as in a mirror, adarsha, yatha, just as, adarshe, in a mirror, tatha, in the same way, Atmani in oneself. That's meaningful. What? What in the world is being described? Yatha adarshe. More fill in the blanks. But again, if we're good enough to fill, we're good enough. We're good at this. We can fill in the blanks pretty well. So, yatha adarshe, just as in a mirror. What in a mirror? Just as you see your own reflection in the mirror. Those are easy blanks to fill in. Just as you see your own reflection in the mirror, tata, in the same way you see your own self. Now, atmani cannot mean atma, cannot mean Satchidananda, atma. The mirror represents something else, and this is why we have commentaries. Atmani means what? Swabuddhau, in your own intellect. Now we can make sense out of this. Just as you see your own reflection in a mirror, in the same way you can discover the truth of yourself looking where? In your own mind, in your buddhi, in your heart, so to speak, looking within. So just as you can see your image reflected in the mirror, in the same way you can see your true nature reflected in your mind. How do you see it reflected in your mind? That was that akhandakara vritti that we talked about in the last class. When that akhandakara vritti takes place in your mind, in the presence of that akhandakara vritti, you see, you don't see, you are in the presence of a reflection of your true nature, buddhau, in your mind. So just you look into the mirror to see your image, you look into your mind, your intellect, your heart to discover your true nature. Now, there's a little bit more about this. Suppose that mirror is dirty. Suppose you haven't cleaned it in the last several decades. You stand in front of the mirror, you won't see a thing. So Sri Shankaracharya picks up on that. He says, Atmani, you discover your true self by looking within, swabuddhau, in your own mind. Adarshavat, like a mirror, nirmali bhutayam. When that mirror has been cleaned, when just as a mirror must be cleansed in order to see your reflection clearly, in the same way, the buddhi, your mind, your intellect must be cleansed in order to discover your true nature. To cleanse a mirror, you need this Windex. Notice I'm illustrating very nicely how to use a Windex bottle. Anyone listening to this tape or these MP3 recordings will wonder, what in the world is Swamiji talking about? Anyway, we'll let them wonder. All right. So you use Windex to cleanse the impurities on the mirrors. What is used to cleanse the impurity in your mind? Well, first of all, we better understand what is the impurity in our mind. What is the impurity in one's mind that prevents you from recognizing your own true nature? That impurity is called avidya, ignorance. Windex is not going to remove ignorance. Vidya removes avidya. That's simple enough. Knowledge removes ignorance. When knowledge cleanses the mirror of the mind, removing the ignorance present in the mind, then in the presence of that akhandakara vritti, in the presence of that jnana vritti, in the presence of knowledge, your true self is reflected in your own mind. Knowledge takes place. All right. Now, that's one possibility. One possibility is to discover your true nature, looking in yourself, looking in your own mind. But there are some other possibilities here that are discovered here. The yata swapne tata pitraloke. It goes from obscure to more obscure. Yata, just as, swapne, just as in a dream, tata pitraloke. In the same way, in pitraloka, the world of our ancestors, the ancestors' world. Now, to understand this kind of looking at, in verse 2, we said, if you get it now, in the prior mantra, in the fourth mantra, if you gain enlightenment now, you are freed from worldly suffering. Otherwise, you are subject to rebirth. You will be reborn. So suppose, taking that case, suppose your mind is still full of ignorance. The impurity of ignorance is present in your mind. You're unable to discover Brahma Vidya in this life. You're unable to discover your true nature in this life, looking within. Then what will happen? You'll get reborn. Suppose you get reborn, Pitraloke, in the world of the ancestors, in some heavenly realm. So if you're reborn in the world of the ancestors, it says, yata swapne, just as in a dream, tata, similarly, in the world of the ancestors. Very obscure, but to explain. Yata swapne, just as in a dream. When you dream, how clearly do you see the various objects and people in the dream? Occasionally with some clarity, but usually it's pretty fuzzy. Right? Whatever we experience in most dreams is very fuzzy, very indistinct. Sri Shankara says, avivikta, indistinct, avivikta. So whatever you discover in a dream is avivikta, indistinct. Suppose you're reborn in a heavenly realm called Pitraloka. How distinctly will you be able to discover your true self? As distinctly as in a dream. That's what the mantra is saying. Just as whatever you experience in a dream will be indistinct, in the same way, if you're born into some kind of pitraloka, some kind of heavenly realm, whatever discovery of your true nature you attempt to gain in that life, it will be similarly indistinct. Why indistinct? Sri Shankara explains, is due to karma. Whatever we experience in a dream is due to karma. Whatever happens during our waking state kind of gets carried over into our dream state, and that's a very indistinct experience. In the same way, due to karma, one could get reborn into Pitraloka, but the result of karma will result in an indistinct experience. So just as any experience in a dream will be indistinct, in the same way, any attempt to discover your true nature in Pitraloka, in some heavenly realm, it will be indistinct. And now, not only Pitraloka, how about Gandharvaloka? So, yata apsu pari eva dadrashe tata Gandharvaloke. Tata, in the same way, Gandharvaloka. So Gandharvaloka is a better heaven. You got different seven heavens. There's a list. Seven heavens. So Gandharvaloka is a better place. It's like if you go to hotels, there are some that are better than others. I guess you have 4-star hotels and 5-star hotels and like that. So Pitraloka is a 4-star hotel. Actually, not even that. Pitraloka, maybe a no-star hotel, just very basic. Gandharvaloka has several stars. Okay. So, yata apsu, just yata, here's the metaphor, yata, just as apsu, looking into, in water. And the metaphor is, you're not looking in a mirror, you're looking in water. So a lot of blanks to fill in. So just as when you look into water, pari eva dadrashe, pari dadrashe, eva. At pari drashe, you see it all variously. There's ripples in the water, and the ripples in the water will distort the image, and you'll see the image pari dadrashe. It'll be all over. The image will be all over. The image will be scattered across the surface of the water. Shankara says once again, avivikta. The image will be indistinct. So just as if you look at your reflection in water, it will be indistinct. Upsu, in water, paridadrishe, the image will be indistinct. Tata, in the same way, if you make it to Gandharva Loka in your next life, which is a better heaven, even there, it will be avivikta, indistinct. Any effort to discover your true nature in a better heaven, Gandharva Loka, the result will still be indistinct. So again, failing to gain Brahma Vidya in this life, failing to look into your, failing to clean the mirror of your mind adequately to make the discovery in this life, if you're reborn in Pitra Loka, you won't gain Brahma, you won't gain knowledge, you won't get enlightenment. If you're born into a better heaven, Gandharva Loka, you still won't gain enlightenment. The result will still be avivikta, indistinct. So Pitra Loka is a zero-star hotel, and Gandharva Loka has several stars. Brahma Loka, five-star hotel. All right? This is a metaphor, different heavens. So now you're going to the five-star hotel. You get in Mumbai they have that Taj Hotel. There you go, five-star hotel. Right by that India Gate. Good. I remember going into that hotel and spending I think 50 rupees on a cup of tea. And that was years ago. I'm sure it'll be 100 rupees today. more than 100. So a cup of tea will be what? A couple hundred rupees in this hotel. That's five stars. That's what you get for five stars. $200 cup of tea. 200 rupee. All right. So suppose you go to this Brahmaloka, the five-star hotel. The idea is that if you collect sufficient punya in this life, you go to the highest of all heavens. And look what the verse says. In this highest of all heavens, chaya atapayoho eva. What you're looking for is like chaya, shadow, and atapa, light. Shadow and light. Distinct shadow and light. Shishankara says, atyanta viviktaha, absolutely distinct. So look what's said here. If you can make it to this highest of heavens, you couldn't discover your true nature distinctly in the lower heavens. But in this highest of heavens, the Rishi says, chaya atapayoho, it is as distinct as light and shallow. Shankara says, it's absolutely distinct. You can definitely recognize your true nature in this highest of heavens. This is a doctrine that we've talked about actually last year. We called it Krama Mukti. Do you remember that discussion? This is actually a doctrine or a belief system that says, if you make it to the highest of heavens, you can gain enlightenment in that highest of heavens at the end of the kalpa, at the end of time. Now, this is a teaching that we find in many scriptures. It's part of the doctrine of karma, which means, once again, it's unverifiable. You can't prove the existence of Krama Mukti, nor can you disprove the existence of Krama Mukti. But what we do have is shastric evidence for it. The scriptures have many references to Krama Mukti, so we give it the benefit of the doubt. If many scriptures say that there's Krama Mukti, there's no reason to doubt it. So here's, and we're going to come now to this brilliant passage of Shankaracharya. Look at this. In this life, You can try to clean the mirror of your mind, but suppose it's really hard. Oh, my mirror is so dirty. I don't know, which means I have so much ignorance, I don't know if these teachings of Vedanta are ever going to help me come out of this ignorance. Maybe in my next life I can get enlightenment. Well, we've already seen, if you're born into Pitraloka in your next life, which is heaven, you're out of luck. That zero-star heaven won't be good enough. If you've really done a lot of punya karma in this life, maybe you can make it to Gandharva Loka, the three-star heaven. And in the three-star heaven, you're still out of luck. You're not going to gain enlightenment in the three-star heaven. But if you do an incredible amount of punya karma in this life, maybe, just maybe, you can make it to the five-star heaven, Brahmaloka, and gain enlightenment there. Maybe. Here's Sri Shankaracharya's comment. And I love this. He says, Chaya tapayoho atyanta vivikdam brahmaloke. We already said that. That you can discover as distinctly as shadow, as dark and light, you can discover, make that discovery in Brahmaloka. Sahacha dushprapaha. But that's very hard to accomplish. How hard? Atyanta vishesha karma jnana sadhyatvat. You can only gain Brahmaloka with atyanta vishesha karma and jnana. Atyanta, extreme, vishesha, special, karma, mean punya karma, good deeds, and jnana, and knowledge. Atyanta, extraordinary. Only with extraordinary effort can you gain the kind of punya karma and the kind of jnana that is required to make it to Brahmaloka. That's, and even then you're not really quite sure. I don't want to make fun of our Christian friends, but the idea is you have to live a saintly life so that you avoid eternal damnation and go to heaven, but you don't really know until you're dead. And then it's too late to do anything about it. You don't really know. And in the same way for Brahmaloka, we don't really know. How much is enough? Sri Shankaracharya says, atyanta vishesha. Extreme and special punya karmas and knowledge. How do we know how much is enough? We don't know. So we can't be sure, and it's so much effort anyway. So Shankara concludes, tasmat, therefore, atma darshanaya, for the sake of discovering your true nature, iha eva yatnaha kartavyaha, you should make the effort here itself. Why? You know, you can have a sure thing here and now. Why bet on your ability to accumulate enough punya karma and all of that to reach Brahmaloka? It's not a sure bet, and it's going to require so much effort anyway. So Sri Shankaracharya, admitting the possibility of Krama Mukti, Sri Shankara accepts Krama Mukti, admitting that, he says, iha eva yatnaha kartavyaha, you should make that effort here and now. It's the only thing that's reasonable. So in this way, Sri Shankara, even though he accepts Krama Mukti as possible, he dismisses it as a viable sadhana. This is Shankara. Okay. I like his language there. Very, very straightforward. You can almost see him wagging his finger. Therefore, you better do it now. Don't wait. Okay. We'll continue in our next class. We'll conclude with our prayers.